Welcome to Keep Calm and Cook On. I'm your host, Julia Tertian. Each episode of Keep Calm and Cook On features a meaningful interview and answers to listeners' questions about cooking. Thank you to OXO for making this episode possible. OXO makes many of the kitchen tools that I trust the most. To find out more about OXO and their products, head over to OXO.com. That's OXO.com. My guest today needs very little introduction. Simin Nosrat is the award-winning and best-selling author of Salt, Fat, Acid, Heat. It's also the name of her new Netflix series. Through her work, Simin has taught thousands of people to trust their instincts in the kitchen and to learn that they even have those instincts in the first place. A true teacher, Simin demystifies and explains and inspires. We met a few years ago. We had both sold our first books to our publishers but hadn't yet completed them. It was a sort of in-between time in both of our lives, and we got to know each other through the process of becoming authors. I love Simin not only for her incredible work, but also for the many precedents she sets for our community and for the deeply thoughtful way she approaches everything. We sat down together recently in her hotel room in New York City while she was doing press for her Netflix show. We talked openly and honestly about everything from mental health and therapy to money and even poetry. Thank you, Simin, for your candor and your friendship. They both mean so much. And I hope this episode might inspire you to sit with a friend of yours and press pause and reflect.
Will you introduce yourself?
I'm Simin Nosrat.
Great.
I'm a cook.
Hey.
Hi.
Thanks for doing this. You are in the middle of such a crazy time in your life. And as your friend and as just a consumer of the work you put out there, I'm just curious, how are you?
I'm tired.
Yeah.
I'm tired. I'm pretty overwhelmed. I mean, but the overwhelm consists of a spectrum of feelings that overwhelm me. So I'm overwhelmed by gratitude. Mm-hmm. I'm overwhelmed by the feeling of, like, incredible privilege that people care what I have to say and are seeing the intention behind what I'm doing. I'm also overwhelmed by all of the attention. I'm overwhelmed by all of the demands on me and my time and all the requests. And yeah, I think there's people projecting a lot of stuff onto me, and that's weird.
Yeah. what did your support system look like a few years ago versus how it looks now? Has it evolved or is it the same? Do you have one? Should be my question first.
I go to therapy. I have an amazing therapist, so that's a big part of it. I've grown a lot closer to my brother, so that's helpful.
One brother.
I have one of my brothers lives nearby who's like really is sort of my – he's the one where I'm like, I need you to go water my plants.
And he'll show up.
Yeah. I need you to do this. I need and he'll do anything. I have a really great group of like both some professional friends and then also just some amazing personal friends. And I think between them, but again, it's hard. And yeah, I have that. And then I also have our shared, wonderful, most bestest agent in the world, Kari Stewart. Shout out.
I feel like she's here, even though she's not.
I feel like she's here too. Well, she was with me this morning and she was like, I'm going to try and come. I was like, what are you going to try and come to?
She could have had some of our yummy lunch.
Some cauliflower for Kari. And I'm trying to figure out how to ask for help. I'm trying to figure out – I do have also, like, sometimes I'm like, the team behind the me is really big.
Yeah.
Like, there's publicists who are fantastic. They're my publicists, you know, Alana and Vanessa from Mona. There's all of the incredible team of Netflix who is just so passionate and hardworking and supportive. But, yeah, sometimes I'm like, how many humans does it take to make one person run, you know? But I do think probably what I need to do next is first get a dog.
Yeah.
And secondly.
Which I really support.
And secondly, figure out how to create, like, I don't know, a small business where there's a person at my side who I'm both investing in and also who is paid to support me.
Yeah. Because you already do have a small business. You have a big business.
It's me.
Like you're the tip of the iceberg.
But I'm just it. Yeah.
And but maybe a more formal.
Oh, yeah. That's the ghost in our hotel room.
We're sitting in a haunted hotel room. So we're just going to say hello and hope it's a friendly ghost.
Yeah.
Do you believe in ghosts?
I do.
Yeah.
Do you?
Have you? Yeah, I totally do. Yeah.
Have I? Well, I don't know that I've ever interacted with a ghost, but I had a sister who passed away when I was little, I do believe that her spirit's around, and I can feel it. And in our culture, in Iranian culture, a moth is usually the symbol of a person who's passed the spirit of their. So, like, when butterflies or moths are nearby, I always am like, oh, my sister, she's nearby. Here.
Yeah. Yeah, that's really sweet.
Yeah.
I feel like there's a lot of that in my family, too. Big time. Can we talk more about mental health?
Yes.
It's my favorite topic. You're so outspoken about it. Yeah. When did you first go to therapy and what got you into that office, if you're okay to answer that?
Of course. I think it was probably – so it's the end of 2018 now. I think I went in 2010 maybe it was 2000. No, it was not 2009. I think it was 2010, January, and I – have always had a lot of anxiety, and it's clear to me now that I've always had a lot of depression, but I couldn't have put words to those things at that time. And really, it was my best friend. It was just like, you need help. This has reached a point beyond, like, you know,
you had
what
been speaking to that person.
Yeah, I was always talking to my friends, and they were very close in my life and watching me sort of spiral out of, like, how do I manage all of this stuff? How do I do this? How do I be a human? And I was like, what are you talking about? I don't need to go to therapy. We do yoga. And he was like, it's not the same. And I said, but, you know, don't I just need to work harder? I think the reason I'm in pain and struggling is because I'm not doing this right. And he was like, no, that's not how it works. Which is very funny because my best friend, the person who sent me, is very resistant to going to therapy.
Interesting. Had he been?
He had been. He comes from like a big Jewish family where like they've been going to lifelong therapy. But
yeah. It's part of our
It's built
part
in.
Part of our fabric, I can say.
And I didn't know what to do. I was like, but how do I find one? And they just got out the phone. They dialed his boyfriend's therapist. And then said, he's really good, like, and at the very least, he can talk to you and help refer you to somebody. So we dialed. We left a message. The therapist called back. And he pretty much immediately was like, I'm probably not your guy. My schedule is really full. But tell me what's going on. So I told him all the things I was feeling. And he was like
– Over the phone.
Over the phone, yeah. And he said, maybe I am your guy and you should come in. And we were sort of apart enough because it wasn't my friend's therapist. It was my friend's boyfriend's therapist that I think he didn't feel like it was going to be a conflict in any way. And I went there and we've been together in joyful bliss ever since.
Wow,
yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
And can I ask another logistic
question? Yeah.
How did you pay for it?
In the beginning, so I have health insurance, but that I pay for myself, which is very expensive.
Yeah.
I think it's over $500.
Do you get it through your state or through?
No, I just pay for, like, I don't qualify for the, I'm like, make too much money for the state one, but like, it's still insane. It's $500 bucks a month.
Yeah.
I mean,
which actually isn't that bad.
Is that
which
not
is
that
wild?
Bad. Yeah, yeah. Which is wild. Yeah. Yeah. And for like not that good of health insurance.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then I had asked him, I said, I asked him how to do it, and he said, well,
him being the therapist.
My therapist. And he said that we could possibly do it where we submit reimbursement forms to the health insurance, but that at that time, I think laws have passed since then, but at that time they could have dinged me in some way because then this thing would be on my record and in the future that could cause them to deny me health coverage. And so, and they wouldn't cover it all anyway, and he did a sliding scale. So he started me at $100, which is pretty affordable, like as therapy goes. It was a stretch for me at times. And there were times in this 8 years where I've had no money and money's been a big stress and I've had a lot of anxiety about it. And so but because I have like crazy politeness issues, like I can't ask for anything. I would go to therapy like week after week and be like, I don't know what to do. I'm going to die. I have no money. And then finally he was like, I know you're not going to ever say this. So I'm just going to force you. So he at one point forced me to reduce the rate to like 75 or 85 for, I think 2 years it was reduced rate. And then when I got my like book check, we went back up and then once I felt a little bit more financially stable, I increased it again. I just – so it's – I think now it's 120 or something mm-hmm. a time, which is still, I think, a pretty affordable therapy mm-hmm. rate, which I'm very aware of. I'm really grateful to him.
Yeah.
Yeah. And it's so the best money I spent. Like, I have spent more on SoulCycle. You know, like like I have spent more
just on – just on, like, the socks.
Yeah. Yeah, like, I have spent more on so many, like, frivolous things. Yeah. And this is – and when I do my taxes at the end of the year and I calculate it, you know, if I go – I can't always go all 52 weeks. But even if I did, that's $5,200, which I am like, that is the best $5,200 I've ever spent.
You're investing in yeah, yourself.
Totally. Yeah. So to me – and I think some of it I'm eligible for a tax deduction. I don't know. Somebody else does all that. So, yeah.
And how – what's the role of therapy in your life right now in this sort of – you're in a very different place than you were
yes,
a year ago, come, a few yeah. years ago. Yeah.
Well, I go still once a week uh-huh. as long as I'm at home.
And if you're not at home?
If I'm not at home, I don't go. I uh-huh. don't do Skype okay. or phone. I really feel with the kind of work that we do, I feel like being in the room with him is really important because mm-hmm. he kind of got – a lot of what we do is basically guided meditation. Mm-hmm. And so – I don't know. And so much of it is us just being present in the room physically together that I don't feel – I don't know how it would feel. After all this time, it would be, feel really weird to yeah. do it over Skype.
I feel like you and I both have in common being pretty cerebral people, like in our heads.
Yes. And yeah. we need that. Yeah. I need that thing of like he brings me, forces me yeah. to go back in my body.
I've done work with my therapist where it's like I have to physically push against a wall or stuff like that. And it's like to be in person is, mm-hmm. is different. But there's different – you know,
ways of
types
doing that.
And yeah. no one right
and
way.
And he doesn't or... even, like, I'm always like, tell me what kind of therapy uh-huh, this is. Yeah. And he's like, there's no, he's like, I'm influenced by so many things. There's no, I think maybe if forced, he would call it CBT. But over uh-huh. the years, he's just changed.
And it's a, yeah.
which is cognitive behavior therapy. But I would say we do a lot more somatic work, mm-hmm. which is like the physical sort of feeling yeah. in your body, yeah. the meditation kind of work now.
How does anxiety feel in your body?
Well, the other thing, sorry, before we get to that, yes, the other yes. important thing that's happened since I started going to therapy, I would say almost equally as important as the therapy itself, is I started taking antidepressants. Mm-hmm. And it's very funny because I was so resistant. Actually, it's more pathetic than funny, but I was so resistant to it. And again, because
it's
I was like,
pathetic.
If I just work harder, you know, that's not the funny part or the pathetic part. No, that's not it. But I was so resistant to it because maybe of cultural things uh-huh. or also my own burden on my shoulders that I placed there, which is like, if I'm better, then I won't need this. And then I went through, if I take this, it'll change my emotional sensitivity and openness and my creativity and I won't be me anymore. Mm-hmm. And he had to be very careful. I think he knew that I would be resistant in all of these different ways. Mm-hmm. So he very gently led me there, but I had to find my way, you know, and drink my own water.
Sure.
with yeah. antidepressants. And but it was really bad. Like, I was crying every day for 6 weeks. It was really a bad time, and I didn't know what else to do. So I gave up. And actually, my friend Tamar Adler, mm-hmm. the wonderful author mm-hmm. of An Everlasting Meal, came to me and she saw me. She was visiting from New York and she was like, you're depressed and you need antidepressants. And she basically took me to the pharmacy and was the person who pushed me over the edge to start taking them. And within 3 days.
So you had the prescription.
Mm-hmm, I got the prescription mm-hmm. over that time.
But you hadn't
filled
it.
I just, yeah, I was like, and like, I was like, but should I take it? And when I took them, I think within 3 days, I felt this like there has been a – I didn't even know this, mm-hmm. but there was a rock in my stomach as far back as mm-hmm. I could remember. And that rock dissolved when I took the antidepressants. And this anxiety that I had had – I also have always been a person who wakes up and catalogs the things I should worry about that day.
High five. This is why we're friends. Yeah. Oh, my God.
And so like
– physically, piece of paper?
No, just in my head. I'll be like, well, I didn't get to honey answer. But mm-hmm. I didn't know. Or like, what could possibly go wrong? Or – yeah. And
preaching to the choir.
Yeah, yeah. And that was really, I felt like that really, like, not, it's not gone, uh-huh. but very much went away. And I went back to therapy and I was like, this is amazing. And he was like, yeah, I suspect you've probably been depressed since you were 18 or 19. And I was like, why didn't anyone tell me, you know? But I just had to get where I was going yeah. on my own. So what was pathetic and funny about that, sorry, to get back to that funny thing, which is that I was so resistant to this uh-huh. thing and then it had such a huge effect and I'm literally on the lowest possible yeah. dose. Like, it's not even that much that I needed to get the thing tweaked. Yeah. But it is such an important part and I'm so grateful. And it really was so immediate and so physical that I don't deny. There's no way it's not a thing in my body, for sure.
It almost reminds me, I have a pair of eyeglasses that I wear when I drive at night. Because when I drive at night.
I do too.
And it's like super dark where I live. It's like things are a little hard for me to see. But I like bare, and I was like, something must really be wrong. And then I went and I got a prescription, and it's like the most minimal.
The tiniest one.
Like you can't even get the ones at the pharmacy because they're too strong.
Yeah.
But it's like I put those glasses on at night and I feel safer and I feel more comfortable in my body. It's like a little thing that makes a difference and it's physical. And it's like, why not get that support?
Yes. I feel so grateful. So
do you talk about therapy with your family?
I don't talk about a lot of things with my family just because we have a lot of – it's a hard – we're in a hard times. Mm-hmm. I talk about it with my brothers. Mm-hmm. And over the years, I've revealed to my mom that I go. We actually went to – not my therapist, but to a therapist for a couple sessions. But I don't know. There's a lot of cultural stuff up against us. So I think about it a lot. I have an amazing Pakistani friend who actually is a real role model for me in the way that she has, like, brought her parents along and done a lot of work with them, and they've come a long way. So I don't know. Maybe there's one day that this could happen. But also, like, everyone is different, and my parents are old, and I don't know. We'll see.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's like your own air mask
thing. Yeah, for sure.
How do you – I'm trying to think the best way to phrase this. I'm just thinking about this time right now, end of 2018, you know, book has soared, continues to soar, the show, et cetera. Soaring. Within your work in therapy.
You're
freaking me out. I know. How do you navigate, because I know this is something I, you know, work on as well. How do you navigate ego?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I don't go on Instagram. I don't read the press. I'm so terrified of becoming like a maniacal egomaniac that I have like preemptively told everyone, now I'll tell you too, please smack me upside the head.
Invitation when you see to things, smack.
Yeah. When you see things going in a bad direction, I think I make sure my friends are close by, especially critical.
Mm-hmm.
You know, critical thinkers, not necessarily critical of me, but I talk about it a lot in therapy. But the weirdest part about this is actually, if anything, it's made me back, what's the word? I don't know, not back away, but like –
Retreat.
I've retreated. I feel like I'm more private and more retreated than I've ever been since I started this sort of leg of my career as a cookbook person and a now television person. It's just so not – I'm very ambivalent about this recognition. I'm very aware. It's so funny. For example, I'm obsessed with Queer Eye on Netflix.
Yeah.
And my favorite queer is, I love them all, but my favorite queer is Jonathan Van Ness.
Yeah, of course.
I'm obsessed with him. And I have a whole fantasy friendship with him in my mind.
Yeah.
Where I'm like, oh, I'm convinced we'll be best friends, like, et cetera, this, and this. I'm always like, when am I going to interact with him? I just know we're going to go on vacation together and drink pina coladas, right? And yet, that's something that a lot of people have with me because, like, I'm really good at being your kitchen friend. And so I've done it in the book, and now I've done it in the show, and I'm so sort of – I am myself. I'm one version – I'm one part of myself on camera, and people are very drawn to that. And I'm really honored by that and flattered. But that's not me. They don't know me, you know? And I'm actually, like, a huge grump and misanthrope and, like, really critical and – really
introverted.
Sometimes, yeah, and like a big part of me is introverted, and so you don't actually know me. So I understand what a hypocrite I am to have developed this fantasy life with Jonathan Van Ness and also resent that everyone has a fantasy life with me. And so it's a nice reminder for me whenever I do slip into that idea of like knowing somebody from camera or from a book or from a pop podcast or whatever, that I don't actually know them. Mm-hmm. Maybe we could one day, but I don't even remember what question I was answering, but it reminds, you know, I'm just so grateful for the people I actually already know and for the people who can keep it real with me.
Yeah.
And I feel like a big part of me has always been trying to be really sensitive. It's funny, like even on Instagram, I have such a, like a allergic reaction to self-promoting the show. Because I'm at this point, I'm like, if you follow me on Instagram and you haven't watched my show, like, what good is it going to be to me tell you to go watch it? Like, you know, you're already there because you watched it probably. But Netflix feels otherwise. And I have an amazing social media team over there. And so they, like, guide me in posting stuff and are helping with all of the social media right now. And I'm like, at one point I had to be like, if we're going to post this stuff, I actually physically need you guys to put it up because I can't put stuff
about
myself.
So someone else has like a password and does it.
Yeah. And like, I love her and I trust her and I let her do it. And she, like, I review everything, but even the act of like putting up this thing of look at me, I did this or here's my thing. That's not what
on a place where people already follow
you.
Yeah.
Like, I don't know.
It's interesting.
I don't repost press. Yeah. I don't even read most of the press. Yeah. I feel like I'm getting enough of the light. Like this week, I'm here in New York for all press this week.
In the Haunted Hotel.
Yeah, in the Haunted Hotel. And one of the like morning shows fell through for scheduling reasons. And the publicists were so apologetic. Uh-huh. And I was like, you know what? It's okay. Like, there's already enough light on me in this show. Like, one more morning show is not going to – will make the difference.
It's so interesting, too. A friend of mine, when my last cookbook came out, the day it came out, they were like, how do you feel? And I was like, honestly, if I don't look at my phone, it's just a Tuesday.
Yeah, totally.
You know, because it's like you look at people mentioning it or whatever, you know, things that have been worked on in press for them to come out and stuff. But if I don't look at a device that shows any of these things, if I am off the screen in any way, it is
then
just,
I still just have to
Tuesday.
Water my dying plants.
Yeah, yeah. And it's really, it's just interesting. It's not good or bad.
Yeah,
or,
it's just
interesting.
Really interesting.
Do you, I'm asking for a friend. Yeah. Do you, in all of your work, do you end this kind of navigating publicity and press and all of this stuff and success and what it means? Do you play the comparison game?
I remarkably, okay, yes and no.
Yeah.
I feel like I'm better about it than I used to be. I think I feel like there's one person who shall not be named. Who is a delightful human who I've never met.
It's Jonathan Van Ness.
It's Jonathan Van Ness. who I like look at them and their career and I'm like, oh, interesting, interesting. And I watch this person's success and I know for my own self that if I didn't have my own success, like I would be driven mad by this person's success. Not anything about the person.
Yeah.
Just like the success.
Yeah.
Even though I don't begrudge. I don't know how to describe it. Mm-hmm. So no, I don't think anyone's immune from it. But I am much, it doesn't haunt me. I'm also like, oh, I know that I have achieved already beyond anything that I could have imagined. I feel really lucky. Mm-hmm. The part of the comparison thing that makes me really sad and freaked out is that when it occurs to me occasionally that I bet I'm making, that my success makes other people, including people who I really love, feel bad about themselves.
Yeah.
And that makes me feel really sad because I know what it is like to be on the other side and I don't want to be the source of that for people. So I think that's another big motivation for me to like bring other people along as much as I can.
Why do you think that happens not to you
to
in
us.
Particular, but to us.
I think like capitalism is the root of everything, you know, more. Like, and I think a lot of it ultimately is like insecurity of any kind, right? So like sometimes it's financial insecurity. Mm-hmm. Like if I could only sell more books, then I wouldn't have to worry. Or, you know, emotional insecurity or whatever. Wow, she looks really pretty and happy and thin. Wow, you know, or whatever. Yeah. So, or like, wow, that relationship. I wish I had a husband like that. So, I think all of the it comes from that, and usually it comes, I notice, from like when I'm coming from scarcity mindset versus like abundance mindset. And like I always am like, it doesn't harm me in any way to bring someone else up. And this is something I've been thinking about a lot, excuse me, but is like this is a much larger conversation, which we may or may not, you may or may not take us there. I don't know.
Yeah.
But like we talk when we talk about like diversity and inclusion.
Yes.
And people, you know, I'm just having this moment where I'm like, you know, true diversity and inclusion is not when like the 7 brown and black people who are the most excellent get a voice in the, at the table. It's when there are as many mediocre brown and black people at the table because there's so much white mediocrity. Uh-huh. There's so much male mediocrity. There's just so many voices in the world. So why can't there just be more voices instead of trying to enforce this like idea that only the most best of the like oppressed voices can rise to the top. No, it should be that there's just more. The more is, and I think to be like totally honest, I think that's one thing, not to say Netflix is a house of mediocrity, but but like there is an incredible thing about Netflix, which is very much that they realize the world is a huge diverse place. People have hugely diverse tastes and there's something for everyone. Mm-hmm. And so something that may be completely anathema to me is actually really pleasing to somebody else. And the algorithm shows them that thing. And so there's a market for that show and my show.
Yeah.
And I think like when we fully understand that. So I think for me, realizing how starved people have been for like the sheer amount of think pieces that have been written about me in this show, I'm like, oh God, like they need more to focus on. If they're, if people are getting that deep on like my yellow pot or whatever, you know, there's, we just need to give them more because the cooking yellow pot. And so it's just, I don't know, it's interesting.
I think there's an interesting parallel to what we were talking about with therapy, because if there was one type of therapy that meant everyone could be in, you know, sound mental health and it was accessible and affordable for everyone, like it wouldn't be hard to figure out what works for you. If there's one right way of achieving physical health. What you eat, exercising, anything, you know, like these industries wouldn't exist. So it's sort of that sort of scarcity, abundance mentality. I mean, it applies to everything.
Everything.
And it's really, I just think for, I can only speak for myself, but it's, I mean, it's part of why I value my friendship with you so much, because I could see a version where we didn't know each other and couldn't talk about this stuff.
Totally. I was like, ugh, that other curly-haired cook.
There can be two curly-haired. Oh, my God. I saw your...
Oh, yeah, all the things.
Your diva charm. Oh, my God. Right? The hand?
Yeah, the hand. It's very important. Do you have one?
I don't.
Oh, yeah. I mean, you, I don't know how you get such good curls without... Because I know you're not obsessive over... Mm-hmm. We talked about this because you... The first time I met you... I think you had just had a Diva Chan haircut.
You were
one and only. And you had the products and you were like, I don't know about this or whatever. Whereas like I have become fully a cult member.
There's not one right way to have curly hair. I don't do very much.
Yeah.
But I do. I have a routine.
So good.
Well, thanks.
Yeah. They're I'm just like in shock at how good they are. They're so good. Yeah.
But there's really, I think it's like there's room for all of us, but I think we've been taught to feel that there isn't. And I still find myself comparing myself, I mean, to all, I mean, including you. And, you know, and it happens so much, but it's like, to me, the best way to work through that, and I'm just reminding myself, I don't know that I actively do it, but is to just talk about it and to talk through it.
Yeah, I think talking about it's really important.
And to acknowledge it, name it, and like make it feel less scary.
I've had, I mean, I feel like I try to make space for all my friends, especially now that I have, again, like, I think what's complicated in, like, some of my closest friendships with, like, writers back home is that we all make different choices. And I think implicit in any sort of, like, success or joy is a lot of sacrifice. So for me, I don't have kids. Mm-hmm. And I don't – and I, a big part of me wishes that I did have, like, a husband and kids. And I didn't – like, that just didn't sort of evolve for me in my life up to now, and I don't have that. And I may never have kids. And, like, there is a sadness about that. I've mourned a big part of it. But I also get this other thing because I didn't have that. And so there's just been – and how many, like – you know, how many years did I just work 7 days a week in a restaurant and say no to so many things? How much writing did I do? And, you know, like to work, like there's been a lot of stress to get this thing.
Yeah.
And I think it's important to remember that things don't like come. I mean, I don't think things come easily to anyone except like maybe a few rich white guys. But like, it's, and so with my friends, I think who are watching me, I can sense from some of them like a fear of maybe losing me or a fear of, I don't know, like what's happening. What? So I try to make a lot of space for everyone to, for, so that for us to talk about it in whatever way makes sense for us. Yeah. Some people are less like, don't want to sit down and spill their guts or whatever. But I do think it's complicated because like I'm also aware that not everyone wants to hear me complain about the hardship of fame or the hardship of making my own show based on my book, you know, and there are those hardships.
Like,
so then it's been
you.
Like having to figure out who are the people, the appropriate people to talk to about that with about that.
Yeah. Probably
has been interesting.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And life isn't linear.
No, not at all. Yeah. I feel like it's a big spiral.
Yeah. A little cinnamon bun of life. Just in another, you know, lighthearted topic, can we talk more about money?
Oh, sure.
Yeah. Because you've mentioned it a few times, and I'm wondering, not in any specific numbers, but what your just financial life looks like now versus pre-book, pre-show.
Okay, so in, well, in 2009, I stopped working in restaurants. Mm-hmm. Up until then, I had worked in restaurants for about 12 years straight, except when I lived in Italy, I was an apprentice, so I didn't make money there. So from 2004 to 2009, I worked so much straight. And on my days when I wasn't at the restaurant, I worked catering. So I ended up saving, because I was only working and not spending, I actually had probably about $50,000 saved up. And that was really useful because then when I switched and I was like, okay, I'm not going to work in restaurants anymore. I'm going to transition to, you know, eventually to like mostly writing. And that came really handy because I was getting paid 25 bucks a yoga journal post,
one lucrative career to another.
Yeah, totally. And so, and like the nice thing is I do have the skill of cooking, so I can jump into a kitchen at any time. Mm-hmm. And that came in really handy because I had a few years where I made between $12,000 and $18,000 of income. I ended up living off of that money that I had saved. And then I ended up hurting my knee and I needed knee surgery, so I had to pay for that out of it. So by the time I sold the book in 2013, I was back to basically zero dollars. And then
were you in debt?
I wasn't in debt, luckily, but I was like basically at zero. Yeah. And then, although I think at one point I did have to borrow $5,000 from my brother, but then I paid him back like right away. Cause then I got my book money, which I more or less lived off of for the 9,000 years it took me to write my book.
In all that advance came to like.
I mean, it's funny because it felt like this huge advance, but then like by the time you divide it and like spread it out, and then also because I'm a crazy person who wanted to spend like so many attempts at testing everything and all that takes a lot of time and money, and then you're living off of your beans that you're eating and like your heating bill and like the unexpected whatever physical therapy.
Sure.
And so pretty much by the time my book came out, I think it wasn't completely gone, but it was mostly gone. Mm-hmm. And then I got like a decent amount of money for the show. But again, I'm not Rachel, you know, I'm not like, I was going to say Rachel, Jennifer Aniston, you know, like I'm not like a million.
Are you a Jennifer or a Rachel?
Probably a Phoebe, let's be honest. Or a Chandler, maybe. Probably a Chandler. or maybe a Ross, he's pretty, I don't know. Or maybe Gunther.
Gunther. Oh my God, what a memory.
I don't know. I've been always okay. Like I actually got in a really bad car accident a few years ago and I had to buy my car got totaled and I needed a new car. And I had the money to do that without like being super duper stressed, which was like a miracle and telling. Mm-hmm. But I had never had that before. But at this point, most of my income comes from selling books because the money I got
like
from the
residuals.
Show. Yeah. It's all like, what is it called? Whatever the word is. Yeah. Residuals. Mm-hmm. And so buy my book, please. Thank you. Every book is $3 in my pocket. And I'm not sure.
And it's going to your therapy.
Yeah. And it basically pays for therapy. Yeah. Like it's all a cycle.
Yeah.
It all ends up in my doctor's pocket. And so I don't know. It feels, but I do feel... I feel fine. Mm-hmm. I feel like I'll be fine for another few years.
Yeah.
I don't have the kind of capital to like make any huge decisions. So when I decide, I just need to sort of have some downtime to figure out what I really want to do, how a person does that, and like what kind of choices I want to make. Like if it's more important to create a company where I get to support people and together we're making stuff and the way that we're going to make the money is through me. Because I'm at this point, essentially, I'm the product.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm limited to how much me there is to go around, right? Or buy that. And so if I'm going to write a book and make a show and do this and do that, like there's only so much me. Those things take time and I want to do it really carefully and thoughtfully.
Yeah.
So I don't know. I need to like sit down and have a sort of a brain trust meeting.
You're a deeply curious person who I feel like is always searching for something.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the things
Will
you just
I ever
described.
Find it? I don't know.
When do you feel most satisfied?
I feel so happy when I'm with my friends and when we're not talking about me or anything I'm doing, and when we're like just spending time together. I really like asking other people questions and hearing other people's stories. I think being seen by my friends and seeing my friends, seeing people makes me the happiest.
There's like a vulnerability to that.
I think I feel the fullest when I feel close to people, I think. Yeah. So I'm always like, that's what I'm hungry for is how do I feel close to people? And like, I want to feel hugged. It's also, I realized the other day in therapy, actually, I was like, oh, I think that's why I'm obsessed with cozy things. And like, I have so many like sheepskins and cozy blankets and cashmere and stuff. It's because I just always want to feel like
swaddled.
Cuddled. And like, and I'm also
gotta
just
get that
a
dog
super, yeah, I got to get
we
a dog. Totally.
Get it for you.
And I'm like such a cuddly person. Like, I just always am like, I just want to eat you.
Yeah.
You know?
When do you feel most free? Same or different?
The moment I push send on a on a draft, like on it, when I file a story, when I'm like, a weight has been lifted.
And you feel it like physically.
I feel it. In my bones, like when I'm done. Well, at this point now, because of the magazine, it's not even when I turn in the story. It's when we're done fact checking. Like when I know we're done and it's gone to print. It feels so good. And I can feel like I'm done, even though the truth is I'm not done. I have to start over again. But like,
Do you have a pause where you're not thinking about
the next one?
I usually
try to take a little pause. I think it's I have been doing it like a year and a half now. And I feel like I'm just now getting a rhythm where I know sort of my body knows like, oh, I get like a 6 or 7 day break before I have to start up again. That feels so good. It's so delicious.
Can I ask you one random question?
Yeah.
So I don't know if we've talked about this, but we both have poetry in common.
We haven't talked about it, but I listened to your Debbie Millman where you talked about your poetry.
So long ago. So my background in it is I studied it as an undergrad, and I justify spending a fortune on that because I try to treat every recipe I write like a poem. It's like this economic format. You have to be really descriptive, blah, blah, blah. What is your background with poetry, and what is the role of it in your life now?
So in 11th grade, I had this amazing English teacher, Mr. Tom Dorman, the first feminist I ever knew. And he taught me to love poetry. He taught a lot of us to love poetry, and he read it to us in our class. He was the first person, like, whoever introduced me to The New Yorker, and, like, we would read The New Yorker poem every week. And I think he really instilled in me a love of it, so much so that I think I really changed course. It was the first time where I felt something that I was actually interested in rather than like, oh, I need to be a doctor because that's going to make my family proud. So that really switched me to wanting to be an English major. And I knew I wanted to study poetry in school. So I did, and I had the incredible like fortune. I got to study with Bob Haas, who's so
incredible.
Amazing and just has been so kind and wonderful. And also Stephen Booth, who's not a poet, but a poetry scholar, who they were two like really formative teachers for me. And I was ready to go to get an MFA in poetry actually. And I didn't. And I was going to go to Sarah Lawrence and study with Thomas Lux. I got in and I was going to study with Thomas Lux, this incredible poet who I was so, so just inspired by and really wanted to learn from. And the weekend I went to the like prospective students weekend was the same weekend that Chris Lee, the chef who was my mentor, was in Italy with on a family vacation with his family. And I had asked him to ask Benedetta, the chef who I wanted to work with, if I could work with her. And she said yes. And he emailed me and said, Benedetta said you can come. So I was like, what do? Do I spend $90,000 to become a broke poet? Or do I go to Italy and like not get paid to do this other thing? And so I was able to defer. So it wasn't, I didn't have to make the decision. So I deferred. I went to Italy and then I never ended up going back to get the thing. So poetry sort of like fizzled in some ways. I mean, I still buy a lot of it. I read a lot of it.
Do you write it?
I don't write it anymore.
Do you think about it?
I do think about it. I feel stuck in a lot of writing ways. I feel like it's a something I would, sometimes I'm like, maybe I got to start doing morning pages or something, mm-hmm. or even just writing in my journal, like, mm-hmm. which was a really important thing for me for like 10 years. Mm-hmm. And I let go of that a long time ago, but I feel like that would be a good thing for me to do, to just write for joy, you know? And as for it's funny because I have pushed so hard against being a person who has to write recipes because I hate it. Uh-huh. Unlike you, I hate it so much.
No, this is a big difference between us.
And now that I just have to do it and I realize that it's a tool that I can use mm-hmm. to get the people who I'm trying to reach mm-hmm. to where I want them to go, mm-hmm. I actually have grown to take like some pleasure mm-hmm. in the restrictions of the form. And I feel like constriction is it's a really beautiful thing in everything, in cooking and in writing. And like, it does make recipe writing really poetic. And actually I should send you this beautiful story. I have a friend, Jessie, who's both a recipe writer and a poet, Jessie Washburn. And she wrote beautiful like essay, and treatise. It was like one of the like pieces in her MFA about like the overlap between poetry and recipes. And
oh my God.
It's so gorgeous.
Oh, I have to read it.
Wow. I'll send it to you. But that, the idea that there is so much to accomplish in a recipe mm-hmm. and like everywhere has their own different style.
Yeah.
And, you know, like it's interesting even now that I'm more indoctrinated in the time style and going back when I look at the ones in my book and I'm like, ugh, like this is so unrestrained. Like, like there's all these thes.
Yeah. Because in the paper, there's real estate.
There's, totally.
Limited.
Yeah. Whereas in the book, I'll just add more pages.
Yeah.
That's so interesting. It's interesting. I do take joy in that part of it. I really mm-hmm. like the, like, how do I teach this thing? How do I draw a picture of it for mm-hmm. you? How do I make it really clear, but also
with
remain
words.
Concise? Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah.
What did you write your poems about?
I actually remember some of my very first poems were about the Food Network. I was a very humorous poet.
You're funny.
And so, and this was like 1997 when like the Food Network was still pretty new. I was not yet a cook or interested in cooking, but I fully went through this phase where I was fascinated by Emeril and his BAM.
Did you write an ode to Emeril?
I wrote a whole thing about Emeril and BAM. I could probably find it. I wrote a lot about kids I knew. I wrote a lot about like the natural world.
Uh-huh.
And yeah, I wrote a lot about feelings. I have a lot of those. Yeah.
Amazing. Well, I kind of think it helps. I don't know if this is useful at all, but it helps me personally when I think about my work as a cookbook author, which we share my work in just navigating the world as such, and just my being a person in this world. Sometimes I forget that, you know, I have this love for poetry. And when I think about navigating the world just as a poet, even if I'm not, you know, selling these poems and making a living, but to define myself as one makes everything else make sense.
Oh, that's so nice. That's so nice. Because
I think if you're a poet or you're interested in poetry, you're always looking. You're looking at details.
Yes.
You're looking for connections.
They're very
observant.
Yes.
Articulate these things and just see them. So I'm just saying it out loud, but
I love
think it's
that.
Helpful.
I love
yeah.
that. I feel like I really love that, and I feel that sort of I don't know, power. I ascribe that sort of power just to the word writer, and it took me a long time to have like the confidence and let go of the imposter syndrome enough to refer to myself as a writer.
When did you first?
I don't know. I was doing it tentatively probably as early as like 2009, which was like when I wrote my
first. When you left restaurants.
Yeah, I think I started writing for the Chronicle, the San Francisco paper, in 2008. And I wrote a couple pieces while I was still in the restaurant. And then I had already written for Edible San Francisco a couple pieces when I was still in the restaurants. And then I started working in an office that's all writers and many, many journalists, many of whom are like best-selling authors and NPR and New York Times writers. So next to them, I felt like a total fraud. So I think it took me several years of going to work there, sitting there, to be able to call myself a writer. And now my fraud, my like internal, because there's always something.
Yeah.
Is I'm like, okay, I'm a writer, but I'm not a journalist.
Interesting.
Which also, like, there are different meanings. Like, reporter is different mm-hmm. than journalist, mm-hmm. is different than columnist. And there are so many sort of different gray areas. And it's interesting because Wendy McNaughton, who illustrated mm-hmm. my book, just started a column of her own for the New York Times.
Which is
so
such
awesome.
Such a cool column. Yeah.
And we talk a lot about sort of, like, journalistic ethics and what does it mean to be a mm-hmm. columnist versus a reporter. And what does it mean, you know, and the, like, focus on fact-checking and like, journalistic integrity, but also voice. And, you know, and all of these mm-hmm. things mean incredibly different things. I think for me, I wrote for the paper a little bit before I switched to the magazine. And they're totally different.
Yeah.
And there's a lot that's different. And my work in the magazine is much more voice-driven. They're much more mm-hmm. like, every time they're like, be sillier, be wackier, mm-hmm. be yourself. And
yeah.
whereas I think the constraints in the paper are a lot more seriously sort of like, this is how we do it.
Yeah.
And it's just interesting. I don't know. I love paying attention to different writers mm-hmm. and their voices. I don't know how I got to this funny back end. I feel like I backed myself into a cul-de-sac answering this question.
I'll get you out.
Okay.
Do you want to shout out one or two writers who I'm really
obsessed with?
Yeah.
Okay. One woman who I'm probably going to mispronounce her name, and I pre-apologize.
Yes.
is she works at Eater. Her name is, I think, Pelin Liu.
Oh, yes.
Yes. Yes.
Yeah.
I really, uh-huh. I think she's really insightful uh-huh. and really wonderful. I just really, really enjoyed Ruby Tando's piece about MFK Fisher,
yes.
which I thought was really, mm-hmm. really well written and so smart. Who else do I love? There's all the usual, like, sort of gang of young, like, brown queer millennials mm-hmm. who I'm so proud
Their
of and excited
is
by.
Dropping yeah. soon.
But beyond that, yeah, I don't know. I think I love Nicole Taylor.
Yeah.
I love Cortia
love
Wilson.
Nicole
oh,
Taylor.
You know who's just killing it left and right? Like, so killing it.
I know
it.
Who you're going to say.
Priya Krishna.
Yes. And don't like, you want to see her spreadsheet
yeah,
of like how
I
she keeps
don't
track
understand
of all of this?
How she does it all.
And each piece she writes is
so
outstanding.
Good. She's so
yeah,
good.
She's amazing.
Yeah.
Like, they're all amazing.
Yeah,
everyone you just
yeah,
named.
Totally.
And how lucky are we all to kind of know each other?
Yes.
I think
feel
that's really,
really
special.
Really, really, really grateful yeah. to be part of this. Oh,
yeah.
Also, she almost doesn't even deserve to be like, she's like so beyond and so special. This person who I'm about to,
I know who you're going to say too.
She's the bestest. And I love her so much is Tejal Rao.
Yes. Yes.
And
yes.
so like, she's just so, so good. And I think, you know, you and Tejal for me have been really important to see the way that you do foster that community. And it's been a really good, I don't know, motivation mm-hmm. for me to make sure that I'm doing it.
I have one more final question that is my favorite question to ask everyone, which is, what was your favorite thing to eat when you were growing up?
Oh, okay. The first thing, there's uh-huh. so many things,
yeah.
but the first thing that comes to mind is called adaspolo, which is a Persian rice dish mm-hmm. with lentils cooked in it. And then, so it's like lentils and rice cooked together, and then it gets, this is why I was the best. Was there's fried raisins, like raisins fried in butter or oil, that get all plump and like yummy and fried and good and sweet. And so I think because I got to eat something sweet at dinner was probably why I loved it. But also, like, you make the tadig with it
uh-huh.
and the lentils get sort of sink down into the tadig. So there's like a double starch
yes.
fried thing, which is excellent. And then you put a big scoop of like cool, like sour yogurt mm-hmm. on top. So there's like cool and creamy. There's crisp and mm-hmm. like crunchy. There's sweet. There's sour. I don't know. It's just, and my mom would usually give it to us with like, just like stewed chicken, mm-hmm. just like chicken with like saffron and onions mm-hmm. or something. And I don't know. It was that's like fully my comfort
yeah.
food. Yeah. I
yeah.
love it. I mean, yeah, I love
salt,
it.
Salt, fat, acid, heat.
Totally. yeah, totally. totally. I used to have like a, basically poles, like like my childhood favorite food poles.
Yes.
my rotating favorites.
Yeah.
So like I would keep like lists of from these years, it was this, from these uh-huh. years, it was this, from these
but
years.
That was
it was
the
this.
First thing.
But I think the adaspolo was like the most constant and most sort
yeah.
of like, yeah.
When was the last time you ate it?
Oh my God, I don't know.
Gotta make it.
I have to make it. Yeah. What I really want is my mom.
Your mom
to make
it.
Yeah.
yeah. Well, that sounds
I bet she would, yeah.
Thank you so much.
I love you, Julia Tertian.
I love you. Mm. This means a lot.
Oh my God, I'm so excited about your podcast.
Oh, thanks.
Your voice is so relaxing.
Oh my gosh. I have a little bit of a cold.
Oh, I can't tell.
Okay. All right.
Before we get to our listeners' questions, a quick word about OXO, who helped make this episode possible. Why do I have so many OXO tools in my kitchen? It's because I trust them and they're reliable, and they help my work as a cookbook author be dependable and accurate. They also help my time as a home cook feel much more relaxed. I appreciate OXO's commitment to make every day better, every day. They approach their tools just like I approach all of my recipes. They notice things and solve problems and see opportunities to improve the process, like their small citrus juicer, which I honestly can't live without. Perfect for one lemon. It catches the seeds and everything, and the juice goes directly into a measuring cup that has a spout. It's so handy. Thanks, OXO, for supporting Keep Calm and Cook On. Want to check out OXO's products? Just head over to OXO.com. That's OXO.com. Now for some listeners' questions. If you have a question for me, just send a DM on Instagram to Turshen, T-U-R-S-H-E-N. It's my handle. It's also my last name. Or drop an email to keepcalmandcookonpodcast@gmail.com, which is one word, no punctuation. That's keepcalmandcookonpodcast@gmail.com. And I am so happy because my wife, Grace, is back in the question-asking seat today. She has agreed to ask the questions, so I'm going to pass this to Grace.
Neil Eiffel would like to know, what suggestions do you have for using up egg whites after separating them from the yolk? Please don't say omelet.
Okay, I have a few ideas. The first is to make pavlova, which is, I think, one of the most fun desserts. It's a big meringue that sort of takes the shape of a cake, and you top it with tons of whipped cream and then fresh fruit that you sort of crush, or it could be melted chocolate or chopped nuts or a combination of all of these things. You could also make eaten mess, which is basically crushed up meringues with that whipped cream and fruit. So it's basically a pavlova that you can mess up on purpose, which I kind of enjoy. You can also use them in a cocktail, like a pisco sour or something like that, where you shake in an egg white to it. And my last idea is also in the dessert area, and it's to make an angel food cake, which I think is one of the most underrated cakes, and it's just so fun. So make that, top it with tons of softly whipped cream and, you know, some toasted coconut, and I will be over in about 5 minutes.
Your next question comes from Lisa M. Perk, who would like to know, what is your best gravy recipe?
So I did a gravy recipe in Now and Again. It's for an apple cider gravy, and it's delicious. It's in the Thanksgiving menu, and you basically just saute an onion in some butter. You add a little bit of flour and then a combination of either chicken or turkey stock and apple cider, and it makes it a little bit sweet. It tastes kind of like fall. Oh, there's also a little sage in there, which kind of complements the apple cider really well. So it's a great gravy. It's pretty foolproof. You can make it ahead and just rewarm it. There's no last-minute gravy anxiety. So highly recommend that. And my other favorite thing to do, which is sort of like a cheater version of gravy, is to just combine the drippings from whatever you're roasting, whether that's your, you know, turkey on Thanksgiving or just a roast chicken, and whisk those together with just some sour cream, and it will thicken all those juices. It makes it kind of creamy and delicious, and it's basically gravy without any real work. And it's so good, and it's a great thing to do kind of in a pinch, and also great if you or someone you're cooking for has any kind of gluten or carbohydrate restriction. So it's something I make for Grace a lot because, you know, she lives with type 1 diabetes, and I also love it because it's just really easy. So it's easy for me and it's kind to her body. So I recommend that.
Your next question is from Kelly McCarthy 12, who would like to know if you have any tips for multitasking in the kitchen, especially when it comes to timing things out properly.
My number one tip when it comes to timing things out properly is to embrace recipes that can be made ahead, and also to embrace recipes that can be served at room temperature, and better yet, to embrace recipes that can do both of those things. So, you know, something like, a kale salad or any kind of salad that is really hearty that you can kind of dress ahead and leave at room temperature, a big bowl of cooked grains with, you know, maybe some feta cheese and herbs and a vinaigrette, you know, the longer that just sits on your counter, the better it's going to taste. So making dishes like that are just wonderful and help you feel really relaxed because, you know, you can make them ahead, serve them at room temperature. There's no stress about timing, doing anything last minute.
Your next question is from Homa Dashtaki, who would like to know, what is your best advice for cooking paralysis? How do you get through those daunting or scary recipes you'd like to try for the very first time?
So if you're feeling scared to make something for the first time, One, embrace that fear is just energy. So just go with that, you know, use it to your advantage. But truly, my advice is to follow a recipe from someone you trust. You know, that can be a cookbook author, that can be your grandmother, that can be your neighbor who cooks all the time, whoever it is. You know, follow instructions from someone who is giving you really sound ones. Another piece of advice is to watch someone make whatever it is you want to make on something like YouTube. I think sometimes when you watch someone do something, it really takes the fear out because you're kind of seeing the whole process. My last piece of advice is if you have the chance to ask someone to show you, ask them. That is the best way to learn anything, is to make something with someone in person who really knows how to make it. So not just following a recipe from someone you can trust, but if you can do it in person, that is the best. Plus, you'll just probably have a really great time.
Today's final question comes from our sister-in-law, Kate Tertian. Kate would like to know, are you supposed to peel acorn squash? And what is the best way to cook those things?
Thanks for your question, Kate. Acorn squash, so delicious, but can be a little intimidating, like lots of winter squash. So my advice is to cut off a tiny bit from the pointy end of the squash and then slice it in half from kind of the top to the bottom, so the stem to the bottom, and then just scoop out all the seeds and then fill that little cup that it leaves with butter or coconut oil, you know, just some kind of fat, and then a little brown sugar or maple syrup, and a little cinnamon is also really nice. And then put those squash halves on a baking sheet, you know, a cookie pan, whatever, and stick that in the oven, like a 400-degree oven, and roast them until they're really soft, maybe like 20 minutes at the fastest if it's a small piece of squash. It can take up to 45 minutes if it's, you know, a bit denser. And that is just so delicious. And you can sit there and just kind of scoop out that squash, almost like you're eating half a cantaloupe kind of filled with yogurt. It's sort of that type of thing. Another idea is after you slice it in half, scoop out the seeds, you can cut the squash into longer slices, toss those with olive oil and salt and roast them. I personally actually like the skin on these things, so I wash them really well before if I'm going to eat them. But you can also peel it off, and I think it's a lot easier to peel off after you've cooked it rather than before. So I hope that helps. But really, just turn it into a cup, fill it with some fat and brown sugar or maple syrup, and just good to go. So, so delicious. So thank you, Grace, so much for asking the questions.
Thanks, Julia.
Maybe I'll get her to come back next time. I know where to find her. And if you have a question for me that you'd like to hear me answer, just send me a DM on Instagram. My handle is my last name, which is Tertian, T-U-R-S-H-E-N, or drop an email to keepcalmandcookonpodcast@gmail.com. Thanks for listening to Keep Calm and Cook On. Be sure to subscribe on iTunes or wherever you listen to your podcast and rate and review the show. It really makes a difference to help others find it. Also, tell a friend or a family member. Text your mom or your cousin or your old roommate. Let them know. Also, if you have a cooking question that you'd like to hear me answer, just drop an email to keepcalmandcookonpodcast@gmail.com. One word, no punctuation. That's keepcalmandcookonpodcast@gmail.com. For more information about me and the show, head over to juliatertian.com. Everything about my work is there, and if you click on Keep Calm and Cook On, you'll find everything about the show. I'm on Instagram and Twitter at Tertian, which is just my last name. Thanks again to OXO for making this episode possible. OXO makes many of the kitchen tools I trust the most. To find out more about OXO and their products, head over to OXO.com. That's OXO.com. Before I really say goodbye, a quick shout out to Emma's Torch, an organization that I feel is using food to move us all forward in a positive direction. Emma's Torch, which is named for the poet Emma Lazarus, whose words live on the Statue of Liberty, harnesses the power of the culinary industry to help refugees build new lives in their community. Emma's Torch has a restaurant in Carroll Gardens that you can go to and, you know, support the organization just by having dinner, which is so cool. They also just opened a branch in the Brooklyn Public Library. They're amazing. They're doing great proactive work. And to learn more about them, just go to emmastorch.org. Thanks again for listening to Keep Calm and Cook On. I'll catch you next time.